It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 118 for Friday the 5th of April 2013. This week we hold back very little as we discover how oral sex in the megabat world is massively conducive to reproductive success. Plus, the virtual currency Bitcoin is going from strength to strength and could be about to get its own ATM machines, in Cyprus at least. And as the 40th anniversary of the mobile phone arrived this week, we reflect on our favourite phones of the past, as well as our fondest desires for the phones of the future. All that, plus a tarantula the size of your face, coming up. Ahoy, Nate Langson here. Ooh, sorry, still thinking about that tarantula. And I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And Liat Clark.
Hello.
Seriously, this spider thing, I've never seen so many people looking at a picture of a beast on our site before as this giant tarantula thing that we found this week.
Liv was actually
I didn't find it.
Sri Lanka.
Well, where the little spider, massive spider, was found, but luckily I didn't see it.
Absolutely terrifying spider news, which we're going to come back to in a little bit. But first, we want to talk about Bitcoin. Liv, ATMs apparently are the next step for the Bitcoin juggernaut.
Yes. Well, there's a man called Jeff Berrick who has just launched a Bitcoin ATM, and it's destined for Cyprus, apparently. In the wake of the Cypriot financial crisis, there has actually been a spike of interest in Bitcoins and throughout the whole Eurozone, with people kind of perhaps a little bit worried about the stability of the Euro, and so looking to invest in Bitcoins. Now, this guy, Jeff Berrick, describes himself as an anarcho-capitalist and runs a site called the Dollar Vigilante.
My goodness.
I would trust my money with a man.
And he wants to give Cypriots a chance to keep their money safe from government seizure. So he's developed this Bitcoin ATM, although, I mean, there's a lot of hyperbole around it. I'm not sure how much work he's done to actually build the machine, but he's talking about it, and it allows users to deposit Bitcoins and to withdraw cash or vice versa.
Now, we should just recap what a Bitcoin is, just in case anyone is thinking, what the hell is a Bitcoin?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a virtual currency.
It's a virtual currency that's completely decentralized and, you know, so isn't reliant on any government or any centralized bank.
So kind of like Facebook credits, in a sense.
Sort of, yeah. I mean there's quite a complicated way which you kind of mine Bitcoins using, well, literally you kind of data mine it, I guess, with your computer.
So you generate them with computer algorithms, and when you produce one Bitcoin, you can trade it for various things. I mean, the thing is, these are so popular now that there was a Scandinavian company that now can offers to pay parts of its employees' salaries in Bitcoins.
Yeah, and WordPress takes Bitcoins, Reddit takes Bitcoins. The issue is that, you know, the Bitcoin currency fluctuates massively in value. I mean, the time that this story went up, Bitcoins were trading at £88 each. About 6 months ago, they were trading at £20-ish each. In the interim, that price has risen to an all-time high of $147 per Bitcoin, which is about £93, but it's now back to around £88 each. So that's all within the space of a week. That's quite a big currency fluctuation.
Yeah, and if you have quite a lot of these Bitcoins, then you've just seen quite a lot of money come and go.
Yeah, I mean, if you bought them a year ago, your quid's in, and, you know, now is probably a good time
to
sell.
But not only, if the government has no involvement, you don't have any protections either, the same protections that would be afforded.
No, and we've seen that.
Banks are regulated.
We've seen that, actually, when a Bitcoin exchange I think it was in Shibuya in Tokyo, one of the big ones, Mount Gox or something?
Yeah.
Was hacked, and they lost loads of money and basically gave people money back at their own expense.
Yeah. I mean, in the UK, I think you're protected up to 70 grand by the FSA, which most normal people would be protected by. So
yeah. But anyway, this guy says he's putting this ATM in Cyprus, and he also says that he's had 300 different orders for machines in 30 different countries, including Argentina and Iran. So I guess, you know, he's claiming that there's going to be a whole wide network of these Bitcoin ATMs. But I don't quite understand how he would have got a phone call from Iran asking for...
It's okay. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Liat, would you want to get paid in Bitcoins?
No, I really wouldn't.
If Condé Nast turned around and said, you can all have up to 25% of your salary delivered in Bitcoins, would you want it?
I 25%?
Personally?
Is more interesting, but yeah, I wouldn't. I don't think anyone in their right mind.
It's because you're not trading drugs and sex.
Yeah.
Because that seems to be what a great number of Bitcoins are being used to trade.
I don't like to live dangerously.
No. How about you, Liv? Are you in the drugs and sex business outside of Wired? Do you want Bitcoins?
Oh, that's a loaded question. I guess if they'd asked me, you know, a year ago, it would have been a great investment. But no one could have predicted the growth of the currency.
And
the
no one can predict where it will be in a year.
Exactly. Mm.
Well, let us know what you think. podcast@wired.co.uk. Would you like to pay for future Wired products with Bitcoins? Let us know. Liat, let's talk about Russia and Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. There's been some blocking action going on over there.
Yes, there has. The New York Times reported this earlier this week. Russia actually passed child protection law last November that included a new clause allowing government bodies to order the takedown of sites promoting child pornography, suicide and drug taking, which, of course, all sounds great. The problem is it gives them power to take down anything that is deemed harmful to their health and development, which is nice and vague and vastly open to interpretation.
Well, child pornography is reasonably cut and dry, I would say.
But yeah, I mean the phrase harmful to their health, things that are harmful to their health and development.
Yeah.
You could say a whole host of sites are harmful to a child's development because, I don't know,
and
gaming
also,
is just,
you know,
keeping them away from their studies. It could, you know.
Child pornography is one thing, but, you know, suicide and drug taking, I'm not saying, I guess any, what about content sites where there's depictions of drug taking in programming or, you know, people committing suicide in programs?
Yeah, well, I mean, they've already had problems within the first few weeks. I think a site was taken down, which is an encyclopedia site, and there was a page on marijuana and the whole site was taken down.
Right, and Facebook, Twitter and Google have all been forced to remove stuff now as part of this law as well.
Yeah,
that's kind of the news here, I guess.
Yeah, but so far the content has fallen into this category. For example, the Facebook page did promote suicide and Facebook ended up taking it down across the globe. And with Twitter, they're working with Twitter to take down posts that are only in Russia. The YouTube Google one was a funny one and Google's actually taking them to court because they took it down, but it's a how-to for creating fake wounds, so it should be classed as entertainment. It's not damaging to anyone.
And what about satire? I mean, that we've seen a lot of controversy with that in things like the Apple App Store.
Well, they had that immediately when the law came into effect. They created a blacklist of URLs and domain names and just started blocking them. I think they're supposed to give them 24 hours notice or 48 hours notice so that the site can take down the relevant pages. But whole sites were just being blocked, satirical sites about suicide, you know, not a particularly funny subject, but the content was being removed and even government bodies were warning that this is not perhaps the right road to go down. Vladimir Putin's Council for the Development of Civil Society and Human Rights warned that honest resources could be closed, it could damage the internet economy and lead to censorship. So it's a bit concerning when the government's own bodies are warning against it, but they went ahead anyway. So far it hasn't caused anyone too much trouble, but I think everyone is very aware that now with companies like Facebook and Twitter heeding their takedown notices,
this reminds me to a little bit of a story we talked about a few weeks ago. I can't remember which government it was, but it imposed a new law about content that was allowed on the web that meant that it actually had to censor its own government website. Was that Russia or was it somewhere in Europe elsewhere?
I remember this. I can't remember it.
There was an example of it. I can't remember.
It was. But they did. Yeah, they had to actually self-censor themselves. This is when you don't think a law through properly.
I wonder what's going to happen with like the bunny suicides. You know,
I was just thinking about them. Yeah,
because that's a comedic suicide comic, if you get for want of a better description.
Well, I mean, anything's an open target here. So, I mean, considering their track record in the past year, that could very well happen, and I think that's.
And what about social suicides? You know, where people have just become, you know, cretins, and have effectively ruined their own careers by being cretinous on the web.
And what about all those hideous videos that seem to be come from Russia of people kind of doing acrobatics on the very top of buildings? You know, which is potentially suicidal, but obviously not intentionally.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not allowed to do tightrope walking.
Don't do this
online either. Yeah,
I think it's for reasons like this that we always have to put a big question mark over these sorts of things and think, is this going to stick around really? But I mean, if you want to make a site about, you know, suicide that's funny,
well,
don't do it in Russia, or don't expect to build a business off the back of it in Russia.
They did already have powers to take down extremist content. And that, again, is just like anything that is deemed religious and the wrong way can be open to it. So,
How very North Korean. Liv, let's talk about the UK. You had a fantastic story this week that I massively enjoyed reading about the fact that UK websites, almost 5 million of them, are going to be archived in an extremely ambitious new digital library project.
Yes.
Remind me this amazing news.
Right, so 6 UK libraries, including the British Library, have all teamed up to try and capture and archive the whole of the UK's digital history, including 4.8 million websites on the UK's web domain. And this has been made possible because of a change in regulation. So the aim is to kind of make sure that historians of the future don't have to grapple with this digital black hole where sites of the past get lost. Now, this has already happened a bit already. You know, with many sites which house the kind of online reaction sites and blogs to the 2005 London bombings have already disappeared, as have many of the sites that were documenting the global financial crisis. So there's a whole part of our digital history that hasn't been recorded. So up until now, it hasn't been possible to kind of scrape whole websites because of copyright law. And so prior to this new change in regulation, libraries have had to ask for permission. Ask for permission to reproduce websites. And that's obviously not possible when you've got 4.8 million websites. Now, the reason it's these particular libraries is because they're legal deposit libraries. Now, I don't know if you know this already, but there's 6 libraries in the UK which have the right to request a copy of every single printed book, magazine and newspaper published in the country.
And they've done this for donkeys years,
yeah, since 1662, and that's the British Library, National Library of Scotland, National Library of Wales, Bodleian Library of Cambridge University and Trinity College Dublin. Now, as of the 6th of April, these libraries will also have the right to collect digital editions. That's websites, ebooks, CD-ROMs, and that's thanks to an act that was actually passed in 2003. And it's taken 10 years of negotiations between publishers and libraries to work out a system where libraries can take a copy of every website and store it in a way that doesn't jeopardise the publisher's business models.
And how bizarre that Google has basically been doing this anyway. You can search the Google cache for stories that don't even exist anymore.
You can, but this is the kind of scale of this project is pretty unprecedented. And the idea is that you'll be able to look at a snapshot of web life back, you know, in the future, 20 years ahead of the future. You'll be able to see what did the British web look like in 2013, for example.
This is very similar, I think, to the archive.org that's been around for ages in the US.
Yeah, and that site kind of lets you go to a vast number of sites and kind of check back on it through the years, and it dates back to the kind of mid-90s, I think. However, the difference there is the depth that this new library archive is going to go into. I believe archive.org stores around 10 meg of data for every site that it captures at each point that it captures it.
And I think it captures it every 6 months or so.
Yeah. Now, this new archive will have a cap of 500 meg for every single site, and it will remove this cap for very big sites such as the BBC and gov.uk.
So effectively, they're going to be on a daily basis for some of these sites scraping the BBC and storing all of it as a digital library.
Exactly that. And most of the sites they won't scrape every day, but some of the more regular news sites, newspaper sites, BBC. I don't know if they particularly mention the BBC.
What about us? I mean, we have about 2 million people read our site every month. Do you think we're going to be...
We will definitely be scraped. It's whether or not we will be scraped, how regularly we'll be scraped is a question perhaps we should discuss with the libraries.
Is that interesting?
But the whole thing will be scraped.
But yeah, the whole site will be scraped. And the way that people will be able to access it is by, you'll be able to search online to see what is available, which is pretty much everything. And then, but to access it, you have to go into one of these 6 libraries. So you have to go and sit at a station at the libraries. And this is to kind of... This is the condition that all the publishers kind of laid down.
So the publisher said you've got to do it in an archaic, difficult, old school.
But then if you're a researcher, you know, and you're in the 20 years in the future, perhaps there'll be a new way of accessing it.
But can you reproduce? And are there regulations around reproducing any of the material then?
Yeah, it's
you're
for
only
research.
Allowed to research.
It's for research purposes. But it's an amazing. I think it will be an amazing resource. I don't think the access routes are particularly as innovative as the project and as ambitious as the project, but perhaps that will change as publishers change with the times. I mean, they do have a 7-day window between when stories are published and that people can access it. They'll be scraped every day, but you won't be able to immediately go and see what was behind the FT's paywall today if you go to the British Library.
Now, that's ambitious, but as amazing as this is, and I think it's a tremendous project, it does make me think about the future of data storage. So, I mean, they're going to be storing something like 70 terabytes of data every single year from the web and about 30 terabytes of various other different types of content, right? That's a huge amount of data to be storing.
Yeah.
And, you know, far be it from me to say that paper isn't great, but we've been able to store books and magazines and newspapers and stuff since the 1600s, and they still exist. They're fine. Whereas I have, a floppy disk at home that I can't access, but 15 years ago, that was what everyone was sharing their files on.
Yeah.
You know, so it makes me wonder what is going on behind the scenes to make sure that things that we take for granted now, like file formats, and I mean, when Microsoft changed its file format from .doc to .docx in like 2007, like that called into a real question about what formats are we using and why is this one not supported anymore?
Mm. Yeah, the team behind it have taken all of that into consideration. I mean, at the moment they're storing the data on 4 replicated nodes. That's to avoid any kind of bit rot, but they're very aware that the hardware that they'll be storing it on and the formats that they're storing it in will change, and they're kind of prepared for that. I mean, obviously they can't know what the formats will be in 10, 15, 20 years, but they are kind of looking into it as they go along.
Well, if you're expecting to anticipate to be storing 1 billion pages at least in the first year alone, which is what they're looking at doing, you've got to have a plan in place to make sure that JPEG can also be read in the future.
Yes.
So I guess we need to be storing these in open standards and not in proprietary formats, and they need to be not encrypted. But I guess they've thought about that.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got some terrific segments for this week, including 2 new ones, one of which is Sex Watch.
Wired magazine, now available every month on Amazon Kindle Fire, selected Android tablets, as well as the full range of iPads, from Retina display down to the iPad mini. Don't miss out. Subscribe today at wired.co.uk/magazine.
Welcome back. We've got 3 amazing segments in the second half of the show today. One is something of a retrospective to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the mobile phone. We'll be coming to that in a little bit and discussing our favourite phones. It'll be interesting to see if you agree with our favourites. But first, Liat, you have got a story in our first edition of Sex Watch. Obviously, since we're going to be talking about sexy stuff, if you have any small children around that you particularly do not want to hear about bat sex and intercourse and things, then by all means, skip forward about 5 minutes. You have been warned. So,
and
Sex Watch this week. What has been going on in the megabat world?
Well, what isn't going on? Biologists in India have discovered the male of a species of megabat gives the female oral sex before and after penetration. Not only that, the Indian flying fox's foreplay and postplay last infinitely longer than the act itself.
Wow.
Yes.
Just remind me quickly, what's a megabat?
Megabat's a really big bat, Nate.
All right, okay.
A megabat.
And they're very caring about the sounds of it.
Well, that's how we like to see it.
Okay. Why?
Well, the research team has seen this generous lovemaking on 57 different occasions. So they have decided that this is the norm, because apparently it's quite difficult to actually watch bats having sex. So 57 times you're onto a winner. So it seems the male actually approaches the female while touching itself. The female, unsurprisingly, inches away as the male changes tact and opts for the more generous approach. This lasts for about a minute, just long enough to get her distracted, and then he
Pounces,
goes for the kill, manages to get 10 to 20 seconds of quality mounting time. So they found out that actually the longer the foreplay, the more penetration time the male gets. So
and that maximises the chance of procreation.
Exactly. So it is an evolutionary tactic that you're convincing the female, let me stay on you longer, and my offspring will be guaranteed.
Now,
that's at least the thinking.
Why do they think that they, I mean, beyond, like, why are they doing this from an evolutionary perspective over and above, charming the ladies?
Well, yeah, so that they can have a better chance of having longer penetration and making sure that they actually get the sperm where it needs to go. But also, there's a rather unpleasant for us to think about, I think, reason behind it. It may be that males are actually removing sperm from other males who had sex with their conquest earlier. But this doesn't really stand up because they actually do it afterwards as well.
Yeah.
And for a really long time. They do it for like, I don't know, 130 seconds or something. So, I mean, they might just be doing it to have fun. I really think that we are not giving enough
Dolphins have sex for pleasure. I think they're the only others that do, apart from us. And, I mean, perhaps the megabat.
Well, I think they have a lot of weird sex practices, as we actually also found out with the greater short-nosed fruit bat, in which case the female actually licks the male's penis during copulation. That is right, Nate, during.
But there wasn't any kind of evolutionary reason for
again,
that.
Again, there's
just
no... Yeah, and it's actually... I spoke to a biologist called Karen Bondar a few months ago for our Bug Sex Week, and she told me that female earwigs actually go for males with a larger penis, and there is no kind of evolutionary logic behind it because it actually makes them slower because they have to lug it around. So it's not, so it's not really an attractive mate. So biologists actually concluded that she just liked it. So, you know, I think maybe we have to reassess.
Well, I suppose, I mean, to some extent, I mean, we see this a lot with, say, birds, you know, that have, you know, extremely extravagant feathers and dancing rituals to try and attract the best mate. I mean, in a sense, could that not be an extension, so to speak, of that? I mean, it's, you know, bats aren't traditionally the most beautiful of creatures.
They're, yeah, mm. Getting the lady to like you,
yeah,
to pick you out of all the others.
Exactly.
Well, I think it's really hard to say at this stage that the one problem in all of this is that very few bats have been studied. Their sex lives have not been studied much. I think it's only 10 species of like 1,000 species of bats have ever been studied during copulation, partly because a lot of this happens in the dark in caves.
I don't think that should detract from what this male is doing.
Well, it shouldn't, but it means that we can't really get a better picture of like the trends in bat sex, which I'd like to see.
I would, given the two trends we've just heard about.
Well, I think we should keep our eye on this, and obviously, if we have any advances
in the
bat sex world, we will check back. Our next segment. Now, this is a recurring theme for us. Thank you, science. Now, this week on Thank You Science, it's going to be a quick one here. I just love the headline. New face-sized tarantula discovered in Sri Lanka. Live.
Yes.
This gets my legs a-quivering.
It really does. It's a massive new spider. About the size of your face, between 6 and 8 inches across, which is like 20 centimetres across. And it's been found in northern Sri Lanka. And it's been found in trees. And they've also taken over an old abandoned hospital.
Several
of
them.
Oh my gosh. Several. Oh, okay. I'm picturing like hundreds.
Yeah. So the spider's part of the Pocillotheria genus, which is affectionately known as the Pokies, which almost sounds like a kind of cartoon series.
I have a friend called Pokey.
But they're also... Oh, really?
Yeah.
Are they spider-like?
Well, his name's Vincent.
He's now going to be known as face-sized.
He's Welsh.
Okay.
But there you go.
Well, hello, Pokey. You're now named after spiders are named after you. But they're also known as tiger spiders, which sounds more sinister because they're colourful, fast and venomous.
Wow.
Oh,
top
my God.
Three spider attributes right there.
Top three things you don't want in a spider.
Has this got anything to do with the fact that their trees are getting destroyed?
It has.
We saw loads of spiders in trees a couple of years ago.
Yeah, these spiders are pretty rare. And a lot of they're speculating that the reason the spiders are moving into abandoned buildings is because their trees are being... torn down.
I think there couldn't be a better reason.
And there's been a lot of civil war and
people off deforestation
than the fact that spiders will come into your home.
Yeah. I think that's something people can really relate to and worry about, and maybe this will be the thing that, you know, tips.
Don't
the
destroy
scales.
The Amazon, or the spiders will come into Rio and
think about
faces.
What's going to happen.
I mean, if you've seen the size of a horse's head, that's basically how big this spider is. Right? It's huge. Actually, we've got a picture on the website. If you're at your computer right now or on a phone or something and want to see this, if you go onto wired.co.uk and search for, I don't know, tarantula face, you'll find this picture, and it's quite the beast. Mm. Isn't it, Liv?
It's a mega beast.
It is.
Like the mega bat.
Well, we've got one more segment, a nice little retrospective one we want to get into this week, called Memory Lane. So So yes, this is Memory Lane, the segment where we put on our nostalgia shoes and walk down the pavement of the past to look around our history. And this week, our balls of eye are focused squarely on the last 40 years of the mobile phone, which is how long it's been since the first mobile phone call was made. Can you, Adam and Eve, that, Liat?
I can't.
40 years.
That's ridiculous.
That's because we're all younger than 40.
I'm really glad that makes me feel young.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's 40 years since the first mobile phone. I think it's fair to say that mobile phones have become of critical importance in our social lives, in the business world. It is worth so much money every year. It almost makes you wonder what the hell we did without them. And I thought it'd be quite fun to look back at some of our favorite phones of the past. And I think it's important to think about how far we've come with smartphones. I was giving a talk actually the other day talking about convergence technologies. And I was thinking about even 10 years ago, if you went away for a weekend on holiday with a family, just maybe just a long weekend or something, you would probably take in a bag, you would take a phone, maybe an old Nokia. You'd take a digital camera, perhaps. You'd probably take a camcorder. You would take, what else would you take? An iPod and a pair of iPod headphones.
Board games.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay, possibly some board games. Maybe
a
paper map,
a book.
All of those technologies, or at least all of those needs that those devices were fulfilling are now in one device or perhaps in a tablet, but certainly they're all possible on a phone. And so we don't need to take these anymore. And these products have become far more specialist if you're buying a standalone device like a DSLR or a 4K video camera or something where you need interchangeable lenses. But I mean, I don't even own a compact camera anymore. I own two DSLRs and lenses, but if I'm just going out for a night, I tend to just take my iPhone.
Yeah.
8 megapixels of joy right there. Liv, what phone do you use right now?
I have an iPhone 4.
Liat?
Well, you know Liat just smashed her phone.
Oh, yeah, you did. What are you using?
I'm now using an old iPhone 3, and it's beyond
terrible.
Painful.
You know there's like the new BlackBerry, Lumias, Galaxies all in my cupboard upstairs?
Yeah, I'm on it.
All right,
I'm
okay.
All over that.
I use an iPhone 5 as well. But favorite phones of the past. Now, I firmly believe that the best phone ever made was the Nokia 3210, which came out around 2000. It was it had Snake on it. The battery would last for about a month.
Snake is literally the first
I love
thing
it.
I thought
list
of.
List the features. Phone calls, texts.
Right. Okay, well,
Snake. We know it's got all that other stuff.
It made great phone calls. The call quality was great. The battery would last forever. You could send texts practically,
to and from the device.
You could throw it at people.
Weeks on
no
end.
No chance of breaking.
There was a guy actually on our website who commented on my story about the 3210 who said that his friend threw it off the top of a multi-story car park. He put it back together again when he picked up the bits off the floor and it still worked.
Yeah.
There's no phone on the market today, I reckon.
It's the cockroach of the phone world.
It is.
And we all still own one. Although mine's a 3310 in our drawer somewhere.
And if North Korea does go nuclear on the world, as it seems to be threatening to do, then you can guarantee that the only thing left will be the North Koreans and 3210s.
Yeah.
Best phone. Liv, give me your favourite phone of the past.
You know, I was thinking about this, and I think it's got to be the Motorola Pebble, which, as a phone, I'm not sure how amazing it was. I mean, it did all the regular things you want a phone to do, but it had such a satisfying shape to it, and it added this. I was talking to Leah earlier about the noise it made. It was a flip phone in a beautiful kind of looked like a pebble just washed up on the shore. At least that's what Motorola tried to tell you.
So romantic.
And it just had a really nice soft snapping noise when it closed, and I remember that so fondly. I was trying to actually find it today on the internet, see if I could find a recording of it so we could play it, but sadly we
it
can't.
It may have just been you who
is that I mean, without sounding overly sexist, but I mean, we always have this massive problem about manufacturers that release phones in pink and stuff. But if you're saying that the best phone was the one that just felt the nicest.
No, I'm not. I have a 32. I had a 3210 as well, and I think that's great. But in terms of until we got to smartphones, none of the features really differentiated them that much, I don't think. You had cameras, and the cameras were rubbish. You had WAP for a bit. But actually, I don't think there was a huge amount of difference beyond the, whether you wanted a candy bar or a flip phone or Razer. I just don't think there was that much differentiation until you got to smartphones, when actually they've become a huge, huge part of my life. Plus, I couldn't afford to use any of the data packages until.
Yeah. Now, I agree with Liv 100%, because the ones that stick in my head are the really kind of awful ones that were really novel and cool at the
time. So what was your first phone? Do you remember first one?
Well, 3310.
3310. Ah, the successor to the 32.
Was my lover for many years. Favoured that, definitely. But
I think that's the one that had a vibrating battery, whereas the 3210 didn't. You could get one fitted.
It was really awkward in class.
Yes. Yes, I'm sure it was. Mine didn't vibrate.
I also, in 2003, I was a mobile phone demonstrator in, I can't remember which show, was it T-Mobile shop?
No way, I was in Carphone Warehouse.
Or maybe it was Carphone Warehouse. No, it was Phones for You.
Phones for You, actually. Yes, I was.
And anyway, I was demonstrating the 3 when it launched in 2003, on the 3rd of the 3rd, 2003. I was the Oxford demonstrator for the mobile phone. I can't remember what, there was two models, and they both had this video calling capability. And although 3 claimed to have a 50% coverage of the population of the UK, it actually, that meant geographical coverage of about 25%, which meant that actually I couldn't demonstrate the video calling functionality in the shop that I was meant to be selling them in.
Do you know what's so incredibly weird? I bought one of those.
Did you?
Yeah.
I had a free one.
I was told that I was the first person in Derbyshire to have signed up to 3 when it launched.
Oh, really?
I was there on day one and I bought, it was an NEC and the battery sucked so badly they gave you 2 in the box.
Yes.
And 2 chargers.
Yeah.
And it was about 50 pence a minute to video call, and a friend of mine at the time also bought one, and he lived in Macclesfield. And I still remember the day that we video called each other for about 3 minutes, it cost us about, you know, £1.50 or £2 or something.
Yeah. I used to go around my friend's house because she had one, and we would talk to our other friend on it.
Yeah.
Just because you could.
crazy
time. Rather than just phoning each other.
But I think, I mean, that's where we've come just in the last sort of 10 years or so. Obviously, mobile phones go back way before that. They were big enough where batteries would have talk times of about 30 minutes. They'd take hours and hours and hours and hours to charge fully, even for that 30 minutes. You would carry a backpack for a battery. And now, I mean, just look at a phone in your pocket. I mean, think about how long that can last, what it can do. The next step, it's devoured our cameras, it's devoured our maps, it's devoured our iPods, blah, 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 all the stuff that it's taken on board. What is it going to devour next? I think it's going to be our wallet. And I think it's going to start devouring it once we get taxis with NFC. Because I was thinking about this the other day, and the average
payment...
Well,
you don't need that if you've got something like Halo.
Ah, but that's just a stopgap. Like, surely the next step is, if you've got NFC in your phone with a payment system on it that hopefully will be unified across the industry, the average payment in a taxi, at least in a London black cab, is about £15, which means it's perfect for contactless payments.
Yeah.
And, you know, the kind of people that tend to take a lot of black cabs around London are probably in a demographic where they can also probably afford a smartphone that has something like NFC. Yeah. So, like, when you pair those two things up, I think that's going to be the next big thing. And I think there's going to come a point where right now you might look at a camera and think, do I need to take my camera out tonight? And you probably think, no, I'll just take my phone.
Yeah.
It's probably not more than a couple of years before you're going to be saying that about your wallet.
Yeah, I'd like that with everything. When you think about what you take out, I was thinking about this the other day, that I often go to my front door with my Oyster card and go to the Oyster card machines with my keys, because it's like the two things you have in your phone, or your phone, interchangeable. Sometimes I go to the Oyster machine with my phone. Yeah, so I'm already doing it. I would like to have all those three.
Your phone up to the Oyster machine to update it?
No, as in I'm literally, there's three things I probably have in my pockets in the morning, for like sake of ease. And when I'm half asleep in the morning, I will interchange the three accidentally. So it'd be great if we could just smush them together
one
day safely.
The office entry card with my phone.
Exactly.
Well,
I'd like my Oyster card that, and I would like to
and my contactless payment. But the problem is then knowing what you're using at which point. Like, am I using my Oyster right now, or am I paying TfL £5 for a travel card?
We'd probably open an app, right? You'd probably open the app for the payment in the same way you'd open a wallet and whip out the appropriate card. Well, let us know what you think. I'm very interested to know what your favorite phone of the past is. Do you agree with me that taxis and mobile payments are the next thing to be devoured by the almighty jaws of the mobile phone? Let us know, facebook.com/WideUK, and for other methods of getting in touch with us. Liat, we're going to end the show by getting you to tell us.
Yes, you can follow us, of course, on Twitter. We are at WiredUK, and check us out on Facebook, or alternatively email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
And if you walk into your local newsagent, you will see a brand spanking new issue of Wired on those sexy news set stands. It's got Ray Kurzweil on the front. We have a massive feature about Singularity University, which I'd heard about a year ago but knew very little about. I now know a lot about it. And we've got a fab piece actually in there by Ed Yong, which I highly recommend people read.
Who told us to get Unleash the Kraken into this podcast.
Done.
Yeah. He failed. But
funnily
no.
enough, he didn't get it into his own feature.
Have you read the whole thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I read that. I read Singularity
Maybe he's
University,
done it in a Rick Rolling style, like first letter of every paragraph.
We'll see. I think James May did that once on Top Gear. Like, he got fired from a car magazine for making every letter on the top of a page spell out something obscene. It was something like that. Anyway, it's also available on tablets, iPads, Kindle, Android. Go nuts. wired.co.uk/magazine if you want to find all the options. We will see you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.
Eierhoglisse is hovercraft.
Why do you know these words?